Bang on the Empire Podcast this week. Andy Serkis, the legend of Mowgli, legend of the jungle, drops by for another chat. All that and more on the movie podcast that is still in with the hope of hosting this year's Oscars. All we need to do now is make sure we delete those old tweets giving Attack of the Clones 5 stars. Quick to the delete machine. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. And you know, Christmas is just around the corner, so I've been trying to come up with present ideas for them. For our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
I've got you some Hamilton tickets.
Oh, that's exciting.
Really exciting. They're playing Hibs tomorrow at 3 p.m. Oh. Knock yourself out. It's going to be amazing.
It's not what I was hoping for. Thanks, Chris. This is great. It's nearly as good as the socks I got last year.
For our resident Grinch, James Dyer, I've got him a gift that will bring him joy. The greatest Christmas movie of them all, Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Thanks, Chris.
Enjoy.
I appreciate that.
Enjoy the wacky antics of Marvin the Janitor.
I like Marvin the Janitor, not as much as I
don't like Marvin the Janitor.
Why?
He's one of the worst movie characters of all time.
Oh, you're very harsh.
He's basically, if someone took the granddad from Blue Bloods and just plopped him into a movie, he's just annoying. He has no function.
No one knows who the granddad from Blue Bloods is except you.
I mean, I do.
I think, Helen.
He's also in Bumblebee.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he makes an appearance in Bumblebee.
Okay. He does,
Not that I've seen Bumblebee, because it's embargoed until Sunday.
Sure. But if I had,
then I'd say that maybe he was in it.
But you know he's in because it's on the IMDb.
Well, there you go.
So that's where you got your information
from.
That's
how I knew.
So if I were on IMDb, he'd be the guy in the garage scene.
That's right, the junkyard.
We are talking, of course, about Len Cariou, who plays Henry Reagan, the what do you call, is he the patriarch? I guess
yes.
He is, because he's the oldest one. He's the patriarch of the Reagans on Blue Bloods, the greatest cop show on television.
It's dreadful.
It's not dreadful.
The things you watch,
it's not
honestly.
Dreadful.
I'll tell you this.
Oh, sorry.
That show wouldn't make it onto the Pilot TV podcast. Oh,
and that is a recommendation. And by the way, I'm cutting that bit out.
And can I just say, your abuse of Marvin, I get it. Like, he's not the best thing,
he's
obviously,
awful.
In Die Hard. And that would be, of course, William Sadler's Chiseled Abler's. Not to mention his shapely glutes.
Don't you mean Sadler's Wells?
Oh, yes, very much so. Good, like that. That was almost like a Mortal Engines gag.
Oh, God. I want to take that back.
Because there's a town called Tunbridge Wheels.
Tunbridge Wheels.
Yeah. Although, and again, oh, no, I can, because embargo's lifted on that. Tunbridge Wheels, the awesome pun, doesn't make the fucking final cut of the film. Although they do mention Chipping Sodbury. So, you know, there's that.
Wow.
Thanks, James.
That was an unnecessary F-bomb. We're meant to be like more Christmassy and elf-like.
It's a festive F-bomb.
Oh, if you remember the Christmas episode of Supernatural, you should replace fuck with fudge. So it should be
fork,
fudge.
Fork, Helen,
that.
It's fork. No. Holy mother forking fork.
Literally, I set my terms of reference as Supernatural, and then you went straight to The Good Place.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just, like, that just doesn't make any sense.
The Good Place is my jam.
Okay, but that's not a Christmas episode. I was being Christmassy.
She was. You were.
Thanks.
Len Cariou plays Henry Reagan on Blue Bloods.
Great. Are we still on Blue Bloods?
Yes, we are. He plays the father. This is my own spin-off. This is my rival to the, what's it called? Pilot TV podcast?
Yeah, yes, the world's premier TV podcast, you'll find. Which goes out every Monday.
Is it?
Mm. Is it?
It is.
How's Keith these days?
Good,
your listener?
Good, good. Yeah, good? He's enjoying it a lot, I find.
That's good. I'm glad someone is. Anyway, so Len Cariou. Len Cariou plays Henry Reagan, okay? He is the father of Tom Selleck's character, Frank Reagan.
Good Lord.
Len Cariou is just 6 years older than Tom Selleck.
That is a truly Hollywood woman to Hollywood man ratio there. That's worse than Angelina Jolie and Colin Farrell. No, it's not.
Or my favourite from a couple weeks ago, Anna Kendrick and Robert Downey Jr. We'll be getting on to something like this later on.
Oh,
we'll be
God.
Talking about something like this later on. That's going to set your little alarm bells ringing, Helen O'Hara. I can see you getting your soapbox out already.
Start building steam now so it can pop up my ears later.
All right, okay. So anyway, so we're talking about Christmas presents, and that actually pertains to this week's question, which comes from podcast question asker regular Carl Jackson at Carl from Wolves. And he asks, what film-related Christmas presents would you like to receive from Santa this year?
Now, I have a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho.
Well, that's a terrifying prospect.
Dear Santa, for Christmas this year, I would like James to not have a machine gun. I would like world peace. Which is, of course, Christmas film-related because
With the United States government, Helen, we don't do that sort of thing.
Miss Congeniality. It's film-related.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can I have props for my sneakers reference, please?
I mean,
It was pretty good.
It was all right.
I don't sound like James Earl Jones, I'll give you that, but, you know. Still.
Nobody sounds like James Earl Jones.
Except James Earl Jones.
That's why he's the only, you know.
Mufasa.
Exactly, returning cast member of The Lion King.
Yeah.
Because there was only one.
Mm-hmm. There can be only one.
And that is correct.
Oh, God, what's happening?
I don't know.
So, what do you want for Christmas?
Well, I was hearing yesterday that if you have the Muppet Christmas Carol Blu-ray and you press pause during the film,
you can see his balls. Stop.
Wonderful things happen. You can't see anybody's balls that I'm aware of.
Wonderful things happen in that the film stops playing. Is this what you're saying?
Wonderful things happen in that there's a little carol break from the Swedish chef.
What?
Apparently. I was told this on Twitter by a person I completely trust, i.e. someone, and I intend to find out immediately.
So if you pause it, it doesn't pause, it just makes more noise.
It makes different noise. It pauses the film.
Huh.
So anyway, I intend to, if you have them up at Christmas Carol, please tell me if that is true or not.
But I do have them up at Christmas Carol.
On Blu-ray.
Blu-ray or DVD.
But I have the American version because it's multi-region. So it should work for me.
We'll have to find out.
That's interesting. I will check it out. Jimbo, what do you want?
We've not already covered this. I'm absolutely serious. I would like a machine gun.
No.
If I can't have that, what would I like?
You can't have that.
Really?
Film related. Also, that's not film related.
I mean, it's literally from a film.
It's from many films.
Yeah, but specifically from Die Hard. No, what would I like if I could have... there's a very lovely 20th anniversary Big Lebowski bowling bag box set, which I believe is a Zavvi exclusive. That's quite nice. It comes with a little rug in it, and a little bowling ball, and obviously the 4K of the film. That's quite exciting.
So it ties the whole room together.
It ties the whole room together, yeah. Wow. I wouldn't mind one of those if someone wants to send me one.
There was great alliteration there as well.
Thank you. What else do I want? It's very difficult. Very, very hard. I think that would be up there, definitely. Oh, there's a very, very nice 4K Nolan box set as well, which has the Batman films, Interstellar, Inception, Prestige and Dunkirk in it, all in 4K.
Yeah. Now, on 4K...
yeah, on 4K, Helen won't fight them on the beaches.
We bought my little brother... I can't say this, he listens to the podcast. Anyway... Forget I said anything, cut that out.
You mean Santa got your little brother something?
I can't even say, I can't even talk about it. Sorry,
really?
Colm, we just got you with coal as usual.
Colm, stop listening to the podcast for the next 35 seconds.
This is now a Christmas spoiler special, specifically for Colm.
We have 25 seconds left.
Okay, I got him the Fifth Element on 4K Blu-ray. It's incredibly expensive. Have you any idea how much that costs?
£30.
It's mad. More than £30.
You're kidding me.
A multipass.
More than £30. It's more than a multipass. It's more than a Lilo Dallas multipass.
Supreme being.
Me protect you.
Colm, you can start listening again. Wow, that's incredible. What a great present. What an incredible sister you must be.
Thank you.
I mean, you're a mug.
So.
They saw you coming.
Well, yeah. Pretty much.
You probably could have bought the Nolan box after
that.
I'll
be honest, I actually got my other sister to buy it for him. But that's not the point. The point is we buy these things together.
Wow.
And he...
You just bought Christmas twice.
Extremely expensive. Yeah.
I have bought many people in my life a subscription to the Pilot TV podcast.
So generous.
But that's free, Chris. It's free for all. We give it away like love.
I know, James. I know. I don't really know what film-related stuff I want for Christmas.
You have all of the film-related stuff. I've seen your study.
I do have quite a lot of film-related stuff. I would quite like to expand my collection of Funko Pops, but they're quite expensive.
Do you know what I'd actually quite like? Mm. Is a Castiel for the top of my tree.
I mean, wouldn't we all? Okay. I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
Which is taking this on a tangent, just because you mentioned trees. What are the three geekiest things you have on your Christmas tree? And I know Helen's going to win this, so I'm kind of setting her up for this, but come on, let's do it.
Yeah, do you want to go first?
I don't have anything on my Christmas tree at this moment. We are redesigning our Christmas tree, redecorating it this weekend, because the first attempt was very, very good, but we need more. And I have to say... If I'm going to get in my soapbox for a second, I'm really disappointed by the lack of geeky baubles and decorations that are out there. Perhaps
you're
you can point me in the right direction.
Enough.
Yeah,
I want a really good set of Marvel baubles.
I mean, some might argue you already have them.
I mean, who amongst us here doesn't want to just fondle a pair of Chris Hemsworth baubles just under the tree of an evening? What?
I'd like a Mjolnir bauble.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
I actually would like some proper Marvel baubles as well. I would like a shield.
There are Marvel baubles available on Amazon and other online websites, but they're a bit rubs.
Yeah.
And you know, it just strikes me that there's a missed opportunity there.
There are many missed opportunities in terms of movie marketing. I've talked obviously about the lack of Fantastic Beasts coats. I also think
I would Dumbledore's coat.
Yeah.
On your tree. That just seems silly.
No, not on the tree, but like generally. Anyway, and also I want an on your left running t-shirt and I can't find one.
But what do you have on your tree, tell us.
So I do have Pinky and the Brain dressed up as Santa. I obviously have a TARDIS. I mean, I think everybody has a TARDIS, don't they?
Don't have a TARDIS.
Obvious. And in terms of geeking, we also have a Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw bauble each from me and my sister.
Solid. I love the way that you've consigned your sister to Hufflepuff.
No, she consigned herself.
That's tragic.
No, they are proud Hufflepuffs, these people. They are proud
Duffers.
People. They are a proud people.
A proud but simple folk.
So those are the geekiest things. But then I just have all the normal, you know, baubles, like a pirate ship, a mermaid, a narwhal, a blue whale. Santa being shot out of a cannon, a badger wearing a jumper, an Oxford student, Shakespeare, obviously. I mean, just the normal Christmas things.
That's pretty good. I've got Longclaw from Game of Thrones hanging from a bauble. I've got a bell with the Hogwarts coat of arms on it. I have
never
one.
Never tickle a sleeping dragon.
Is that what it says?
Yeah.
That's funny. I've got one which has strobe lights and the Empire logo on it. I quite like that one.
Ooh. Sorry, what?
Like our logo?
No, literally, I mean, it's someone's hand drawn it. It's not like it's professionally made, but someone sent it into the office one year.
Really?
Yeah, which I quite like.
Amazing.
That's cool.
Yeah, I like that one. I've got Ferdinand the Bull from
Ferdinand.
The John Cena film Ferdinand. Oh, yeah, and I've got a shit ton of... I've got a BB-8, which I love, and I've also got, like, a load, and I mean a load, like about 40 Star Wars baubles. So I only ever put on a few on each year, like the Death Star one, obviously, because it's round, it makes sense. I tend to put up Kylo Ren, Stormtrooper, Princess Leia, maybe an R2-D2. I scatter them around, and then next year, maybe I'll bring out Jabba, the Snowtrooper, and Wicket. But, you know, I cycle them, because otherwise the entire tree would be dominated by Star Wars characters, and who needs that?
You do.
I do think I need some more geeky ones, if I'm honest. I don't feel like I've got enough.
Yeah, a lot of people have been sending us in the wake of our Is Die Hard a Christmas Special podcast, which is still available. Yes, it is, Helen.
I didn't say it wasn't. This is the great myth.
You tutted.
I have never said it wasn't.
Then why did you tut, Helen?
She just finds us tedious. That's what she's tutting.
Super tedious. It's the most boring conversation.
In fairness, and for people who've been put off from listening to that podcast because it's a tedious conversation, we address that point in like the first 5 minutes and then move on to other things.
To much more tedious things.
To much more tedious Die Hard things.
Yeah. But yeah, people have been sending me pictures of that John McClane in the Airfent bauble. I think you can make that yourself.
That's very, very
clever. But yeah, make more film-related baubles, guys.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll stick them on our tree. And
there is a great shop on Etsy that I won't be able to find that does classic Christmas baubles. And those are great. So there's one that says, obviously, every time a bell rings. But they also have, you know, Christmas wells with Orson Welles' face on them and that kind of thing. Super good.
Super good. I'm just taking a quick look at the stuff I put down on my Christmas list. There's two vaguely movie-related things that I would like for Christmas. One is the Chewbacca Nerf bowcaster.
I want that too now.
Which is incredible.
Yep.
And I've put it on my Christmas list and shown it to my wife for the last 3 years, and each time she's gone, that's nice, and then ignored it completely.
Oh.
Thinking I'm not serious. I am deadly serious. I'd obviously like some Lego Star Wars stuff.
The Lego Porg is lovely.
Yeah.
Mm.
Goes down great with some roasties
and
some Brussels sprouts. But the other thing I would like, I'm always looking to put new artwork on my walls. And someone recently alerted me to the existence of, Columbo, some Columbo episodes in the 1970s were repackaged for Italian cinema because they're feature length. So they were released theatrically in Italy. And they all have, there's like four or five of these episodes, and they have Italian posters, which are super, super fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
And really rare and really expensive. So if Santa were to put one of those under my tree, fully framed, of course. With a Habitat Bacall frame.
With a really big bow. And I'd also like gold wrapping paper, not silver. And a pony.
Yes, I want that. That's all I want. That's all I want. Christmas is sorted. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, to your satisfaction, as Carl from Wolves has just found, you can get in touch with us via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. You can Facebook us as Empire Magazine, and you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. And OMG, I forgot the best Christmas present of them all.
Us.
Tickets have gone on sale this week, this very day, in fact, for our 350th episode. We are recording it live once again at King's Place in London. And yes, I know for people who live around the country that it's London, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm not ruling anything out. We would love to take the podcast around the country, but for the time being, it's London. 350th episode, February 6th, 7 o'clock, King's Place. It's a Wednesday. It's going to be a lot of fun. Do come along. We're going to have spot prizes, guests, 4 giggling idiots. It's going to be amazing. Tickets are on sale now. They make a great Christmas present.
Great Christmas present.
For friends or enemies. So it's all good.
Yeah, I think I'm busy that night.
Yeah, so am I. James, you're... Oh, no, that would be a bad idea.
I know what you were going to say.
He would turn it into some sort of weird pilot TV podcast.
Yeah, talking about the telly.
Keith would come on. He'd have a real... Are you going to do... You should do a live pilot TV podcast at the exact same time.
In
just
Keith's
you and
living
Keith
room.
In a broom cupboard. Yeah.
Anyway, should we get on to news?
Let's do it.
In fact, let's have a guest.
Yeah,
because we've got 2 guests this week. We might as well have a guest.
Who should we have?
I don't know. Should we have Andy Serkis? We like Andy Serkis, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We love him.
He's fantastic. Brilliant actor. He's been in... You've seen him and then mostly not seen him in the likes of, you know, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Hobbit trilogy, some Star Wars movies, some Marvel movies. What else has he been in?
Apes.
Those Apes films where he played King Ape.
Mm.
Caesar.
That's him.
Little Caesar.
Yeah.
Little Caesar.
Caesar's a lad, isn't he?
Is he?
James got that.
Okay.
Caesar salad.
Oh, I see. Okay. Wow, that was laboured.
It's pretty good. Pretty good. Anyway, he's amazing as an actor. He is now turning his hand to directing. Breathe, his directorial debut, came out a couple of years ago. Interesting enough, that wasn't meant to be his directorial debut. Mowgli was meant to be his directorial debut. It is out this week. It is out today, in fact, on Netflix. Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, a new version of Rudyard Kipling's that nailed it first time, The Jungle Book. With an all-star cast playing lions and tigers and bears, oh my. So this has had a bit of a torturous route to the big or indeed small screen, and we spoke about that at great length.
And you spoke to him?
Yes, I did.
So you literally ran off to join the circus?
Oh no. Here I am talking to Andy Serkis. Do please enjoy.
Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director and star of Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, legend himself, Andy Serkis.
Thank you very much.
How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I've just been faffing around with the microphone and the headphones, and I forgot I didn't plug my headphone into the recorder.
But you should have people to do this for you, quite frankly.
Do you think I should?
I do.
I was just wondering, did you ever encounter incompetence like this before in your career?
Never, actually. It was quite amusing.
Nothing like this ever happened on the set of Mowgli.
Oh, good God, no. Never.
If it had, what would you have done as director?
I'm a big baller. I shout. I'm really mean. In fact, I just turn into Baloo. No, this is so not true. No, I'm doing myself down slightly. No,
of course. That's not cultivate. This is your second film as a director. Let's not cultivate a reputation as a screamer or a firer. Let's not do that. What sort of director are you? I've never been on an Andy Serkis set. What are you like?
I like to think I create a very pleasant working atmosphere. I think it's really important to ensure that everyone feels like they're contributing 150% and including them in the story. And I think that's, you know, if you can get everyone to really love and be passionate about the story you're trying to tell, that's what it's all about. It comes from the top, and you have to establish that ethos, that working atmosphere, and actually actively share the story.
Yeah. You know. So is that with everybody? Like, you know,
as much as possible. I mean, for instance, I'll give you an example. Even on the visual effects side, yeah. Because the process of shooting this was, we had our wonderful A-list cast come and be, you know, all the characters that they were playing, acting opposite Rowan Chand, Mowgli, brilliant, for a few weeks at the beginning, and then we edited that whole thing, and we basically had an edited version of the movie with the raw performances, and then we showed that to. And then I wanted to show that whole movie to the visual effects department, all of the animators who were going to be working on the movie. And And apparently, well, it's just not done like that. You don't share that information, you know. So animators are just used to getting sort of the 16 frames they're going to be working on, or yeah, whatever it is. 20. So it's like, why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you share the story? We're all storytellers.
So, but this is a film. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that there may even been a point a few months ago where you weren't entirely sure you would be sitting here, that this film was in limbo a little bit, I guess, or...
Well, no, because I thought originally I knew I'd be sitting somewhere else with... I knew I was going to be sitting somewhere because Warners were going to release it, originally. And it was slated for an October the 19th release at that time. And it was then in July, we'd been to CineCom in Las Vegas. We'd started promoting it under the Warner banner. We then went to Cine Europe. We went to Barcelona and again started the process there. And then literally on the last day I was working on it, which was sort of doing a mix for the Dolby Vision version of this, I got a call saying, "Oh, Andy, the studio want to talk about the release of the movie," and it was with Toby Emmerich, who was a very good friend of mine, and you know, we've worked together for many years on the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit trilogy. And actually, the film took our version of this story took a really major upturn when he came back to run Warner Brothers, because he said, "Andy, I want you to finish the film that you started making without any sort of without being blocked. I want it to be your film."
That was
great. But anyway, he said, "We've been screening it for Netflix, and they absolutely love the movie." They want to acquire it, and we think this could be a win-win situation, which I totally believe is the case. So it became a Netflix acquisition, and they have been extraordinary, and you know, fulfilled their promise to give it a theatrical release. One thing I was very concerned about was the fact that the 3D version of this movie is actually, I think, the best version of this movie.
Yes.
So I really wanted it to be, for it to be seen like that. But from what I can see, and also the other thing is that this film was never ever going to be a full four quadrant kind of family popcorn movie.
No, it's a much darker film than I think people might be expecting.
Yeah, and so it was the international release of it was, I think, what was it, everybody was excited when it was at Warner's, the international release of it, people were, but the American kind of domestic box office, I think, were a little bit scared of it in a way. So I always imagined that this film would start off doing like, maybe we talked about going to festivals, going to Cannes or Venice, or you know, and sort of in the same way that Life of Pi sort of found its way into, you know, there was probably a good comparison in a sense in terms of how to message and market this film. But anyway, the point being that Netflix have got that global reach, and the, you know, as evidenced by the fact we did our world premiere in Mumbai, which was just brilliant, because it meant that we could share the film with, you know, from in the country that it originated from.
But did it take you a little while to come to that understanding that this is a win-win thing, that when this movie opens on Friday, it's not a question of John and Jane Popcorn deciding, "Oh, what are we going to see tonight? Let's go to the cinema. Let's hire a babysitter. Let's go there. We'll pay 15 quid each for a ticket. We'll get some popcorn. That'll bring it up to 50 quid. Let's stick on Netflix. Oh, what's on? Mowgli. Let's watch Mowgli."
Absolutely.
I mean, suddenly your film is in front of millions of eyeballs at the same time.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, and that's thrilling. I mean, that at the end of the day is really all I really care about, is that people see this version. People see a version that I don't think they will have ever seen before. Mm. It's wildly different to anything that's gone before. And
no songs.
No songs, no dancing animals, no, you know, no King Louis eating bananas and squeezing bananas out of his toes. You know, it's like this is a version which goes back to the source material, goes back to Rudyard Kipling's book, and and actually, unlike other adaptations, focuses on its main character, Mowgli. Sometimes Mowgli in the other versions tends to fare not so well because you do spend so much time on the antics of all of the animals and all of the capering that actually you almost forget that it is a very emotional and important journey of self-discovery of this character that is other or believes himself to be of one family and actually isn't, and finds himself stuck between two very conflicting, changing worlds, the worlds of animal and the worlds of man, the world of man.
Yeah.
So it's in the book that is very, very clear, and we wanted to go back to the tone of that book, and there is, you know, the jungle is a very beautiful place in the book, but it's also a place of savagery too, and that and that can't be denied, and I'm just really thrilled that we have been able to fulfill what we set out to do, and actually there isn't a single thing that I would change about this movie. From the ambition at the beginning, that we actually got back to where we wanted it to be.
I mentioned that it is I think a darker film than people who might hear the word Mowgli and they might hear the words The Jungle Book. They might expect.
Yeah.
There is bloodshed in this movie.
Yep.
There is darkness. Mm-hmm. Some of the sequences are very intense.
Yeah.
That's something that clearly you were committed to. Was that just so, as you say, you could set it apart from the previous iterations of this story? Or was that something that you wanted to bring from a personal point of view?
No, it's what's in the book. I mean, the book is a very, very, it's sort of uncompromising in a way. It doesn't apologize for itself, and it doesn't have that sort of 21st century PC sensibility of having to, you know, we just didn't want to wink at the audience and say, hey, you know what, it's all right, it's all okay. This is a true, feels like a truly grounded emotional story that that has real consequence and real jeopardy for Mowgli, and he doesn't just sort of brush himself off and sing a song or get a ride on the back of a whatever. You know, it's like he's got to really work out his next step at every single point of the journey, and that's I think is, you know, people have said this is really intense, and I think that's what it is more than anything. It is darker, but there's an intensity to this movie because things are felt and they're real, and there's nothing kind of violent in it that's gratuitous. It's there for a purpose. So I actually really think it's still a family movie, probably not for like 4 or 5 year olds, but definitely for sort of 8 upwards, I would say. You know, it's not a kind of PG. It's a PG-13 in the sense that, yeah, PG-13 means basically if you've got older siblings, you watch what your older siblings go and see. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, if you're 8 or 9, you're going to watch a PG-13, aren't you? Yeah, really?
Well, PG-13 also means that you're allowed 1 F-bomb. So did you about having Shere Khan drop a cheeky?
That would have been quite good. Benedict's Shere Khan F-bombing would have been really cool.
So this movie, no movie is made inside a bubble. And this movie obviously was announced, I think, before Disney's Jungle Book.
Way before.
And you were casting around the same time as well. That movie clearly had an effect on this one. Can you talk us through that and the impact of that film?
Well, yeah. I mean, so our film was commissioned. I came on board in 2013, and it was a mature script by then.
It had been around for a while.
It had been like 2 years, I think, in development before I came on board. So, I mean, obviously, this is the interesting thing. We Warner Brothers were committed to making this version, and it wasn't kind of, we were not making a version that was in reaction to anything at that point. It was, we were making this version. And then it was announced that Disney were going to make theirs. So obviously there was some sort of, you know, muscling on between two studios, wanting to be the first, and there was a race. Once I knew that was happening, I realized that it wasn't going to affect me that much as a filmmaker, because I knew that they were going to be making a version which had to, by definition, because it was a Disney movie, be a four-quadrant family film.
With the songs and with the dancing animals. With the songs and was
likely going to emulate, it was a live-action remake of the 1967 animation, whereas ours was nothing to do with that whatsoever. But as these things happen, and look, it's not the first time it's happening in Hollywood, where, you know, you start, you know, there are two buses coming along at the same time.
You were the deep impact of their Armageddon,
exactly.
And
it's happened countless times. But then people became fascinated with the rumble in the jungle. You know, it was kind of like it was just like, who's going to get there first? Every time we announce, it seemed that Disney were announcing. Every time they announced, we were announcing. You know, it was kind of a bit of a crazy time, but yeah. We just sort of all boxed on because we were using facial performance capture and the design of our animals was very specific, and we wanted to, because the movie is from Mowgli's point of view, and also the design of our animals were based on the lithographs of the original Jungle Book, mm-hmm. Where they're more, if you like, sketched and imagined in it from the artist's point of view rather than documentary David Attenborough / Animal Planet.
Yes.
Photo real animals.
Yes.
You know, so there was always that sense of it being, you know, through the lens of a 19th century biologist or what I wanted to do, to license talking animals, because I thought the idea of kind of doing a voice booth performance and then putting it on top of an animation of a really photorealistic tiger, the voices just wouldn't sit for me inside it. So the design of the animals and actually having actors play the roles on set, you know, great actors, we had Christian Bale and Kate Blanchett Benedict and all of those, you know, Naomi Harris, brilliant cast of actors all acting with Rowan Chand. But to get those facial performances and the design of those animals took a long time. So we just backed off the race and just went, you know, the Disney version can have their moment, and then we'll finish our film in due course.
It is interesting as well that you're talking about that, the sort of the, I always struggle saying this word, but the anthropomorphization, I nearly got there, screwed it up anyway, but it's fine. I'll edit it in post, of the animals is really interesting. There's a moment where Shere Khan almost raises his paw to his face and scratches his cheek with his claw, which is a very human tick.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Well, we wanted to put that in, and that's his dodgy claw as well. That's his lame paw. And Benedict did that. And we thought, and there was a, you know, that raised, interesting that you raised that, because it's like, well, is that overstepping the mark? Is that making him too human? Or is it, actually it was about character. And that for me is much more interesting than a photoreal tiger just standing with two paws down and it looking more real. You know, this was real in the internal logic of our movie.
You mentioned there as well that Toby Emmerich came back and asked you to complete the movie, because this movie was fragmented in a way. Yeah, you know, Breathe happened in its entirety, I believe.
That's right.
After you started work on this one.
No, absolutely.
Which is incredible, but also crazy. And there was a period when you were not off the project, but you were stepping back from the project a little bit to focus on Breathe. Is that correct?
Well, which was actually a relatively short period of time where there was in reaction to the Disney version, Warners were a little bit like, oh, how are we going to position, how are we going to message this movie now? Given that the other version had, you know, done very, very well at the box office. And I think it shook them. And I think the studio was in a fragile state anyway, and because of the other things that were going on. And so I think there was a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. And so there were kind of, while they were sort of getting themselves back together, I took a step back and said, when you've decided that you want to let me finish this movie in the way that I want to finish it, then I'm going to come back on. So there was a little bit of a period where we thought, well, we'll go off. We then were very fortunate in that Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy became available. Yes. And we had the finance very quickly together to make Breathe, which we then shot. And after that, which only, you know, we raised the money in 7 weeks, shot it in 7 weeks, and then I was in the edit on it when I then heard back from Warner Brothers that, yes, we want you to come back onto the movie and finish it in the way you set off. So it was, you know, it was a relatively short period in the 5 years span of making this movie.
Yes, and that was the moment when Alfonso Cuarón became briefly
he came
involved.
On. He came on for I think about 2 weeks because they wanted they wanted to familyize it a bit, I think, and not to take anything from Alfonso. We had one conversation on the phone, and I think he came in and I was like, okay, look, let's just see. I wanted to be open to it just to see what they were interested in doing. And then And then very quickly it became apparent that nobody was quite agreeing, and that it wasn't going to go forward. So then Alfonso left, and then, you know, then I came back on.
Fair enough. Are you a football guy, Andy?
I'm an Arsenal supporter.
So I'm not sure if that's a yes.
And I was very pleased the other night.
I'm sure you were. I'm sure my wife was also an Arsenal fan. Yeah, she was pretty happy as well. So you'll know then that whenever a lot of players become managers, they will often say, oh yeah, so I played for Alex Ferguson, so I'm going to take a little bit of Alex Ferguson, I'm going to take a little bit of Fabio Capello, but I'm going to be my own man, obviously, but I'm going to take the best of them and try and blend it into something new. Yeah. Is it the same with directing? Whenever you step into directing, you know, is it a lot of Andy Serkis, but a little bit of Peter Jackson, a little bit of Steven Spielberg?
I wish. Look, of course, but I do that. You do that as an actor anyway. You know, you work with all these different directors. You work with different, you know, different methodologies, different people, different processes. You work with different actors with different processes, and the artistic community are magpies, and we all steal off each other. And you know, of course you do. There are shots from homages. You know, I'm sure that Stephen and Peter will have done exactly the same thing. And you know, you do. You steal shots. You steal ideas. But it's the idea, basically, that in order to tell your story, you're informed by so many previous. You are standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, yeah. I mean, yes, no. It was certainly with Peter. I hold my hands up and go, he was a mentor. I was serving his vision when I was second unit director on The Hobbit. How can I possibly not learn from him?
But does that translate to behaviour on set? For example, first day on this movie, do you think, okay, deep breath, what would Peter Jackson do? First shot of the day, what would he do? How would he behave? How would he talk to his, you know, lieutenants? What would he do? Or is it very much like, no, I'm my own man, Brian?
I didn't have time to think about Peter on the first day, because you know, I was
were you in the first?
I mean, the great thing about having done that second unit directing job, and this is Peter's words were, Andy, you know, I'd love you to do this. I want you to direct the second unit, because there's going to be a lot of traffic between the first and second unit with the main cast, and I want you to look after the performances. And you're going to learn such a lot, and you'll be able to iron, these were his words, you'll iron out all of your kinks, you know, whilst doing this for 200 days, which I did. So, you know, I was, as I've said, I think, to you before, I didn't get to make my first sort of small auteur movie with three actors in two rooms. I actually found myself on my first day of directing a huge crew, 250 whatever crew, shooting at 48 frames a second with native 3D for 200 days, shooting everything from close-ups of Ian McKellen to, you know, being in a helicopter for 10 weeks to shooting extraordinary pieces of battle sequences to barrels to, but you know, it was just like a monster film education.
Best YTS scheme ever.
Absolutely. No, it's extraordinary. And it's extraordinary, and I'll be forever thankful for that. So it fully equipped me I don't think there's anything that I faced on that I knew that I wasn't able to handle kind of helming this.
Fantastic. So what are you handling next? What's
well, we are about to we're making Animal Farm, mm-hmm. finally, mm-hmm. Another long project, but we are making that with Netflix, which we're very excited about. And actually that deal was sort of in progress before the acquisition, so
serendipitous.
It's
it's all coming together. Are you going to be in that as well? Is that
I probably won't be in this one, actually.
You'd be a good Napoleon.
Well, I've got someone better in mind.
There's no one better. Ridiculous. Until you announce it, and I go, oh, okay, maybe. Andy Serkis, it's always been a pleasure. Fantastic. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. Cheers.
Okay, so that was Andy Serkis, and now let's get on with some movie news. And
I have some news for you.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've got an Oscar host. They've announced one. It's Kevin Hart. Isn't that exciting?
I've got some news for you.
Oh, what is it, Helen?
He's not going to host the Oscars anymore.
Right.
Well, that was a roller coaster.
Glad we covered that.
Phew. That was a whirlwind 72 seconds, wasn't it?
Yes, this was Kevin Hart, who was announced as the latest host for the Academy Awards, only to, shall we say, step back from that post after his Twitter feed was necroed and publicised and used to make him step down. Did you read the tweets? I was not able to see the tweets because the BBC did not post them.
I mean, they're not just tweets. there are basically just a Twitter summary of a stand-up routine that he did.
Mm.
The gist of the routine is basically, and this is from a few years ago, him saying as a father, he doesn't want his son to be gay. And as a heterosexual male, he's going to do everything he possibly can to stop his son being gay. So when his son, who's just like a little kid, 3 or 4 years old, starts doing quote-unquote gay stuff, he leaps in at the time. And it's a routine I think it actually would work if it were framed in a way that made him really look bigoted. You know what I mean? And so the joke is on him.
Mm.
Yeah.
But it's not. The joke is literally about gay people.
I see.
And so it's a little bit, or a lot bit, over the line. And he has been unrepentant about this until about 6 hours ago,
yeah,
when he was very repentant about it. He took to Instagram yesterday because there was a contretemps about this, and a furore, and people were up in arms. And he took to Instagram yesterday to record a video basically saying, I've changed. It was a long time ago. I think it was 2010. And, you know, I'm a different person now, and I'm in love with the man I am becoming, yes, which is an amazing quote.
It's a very odd turn of phrase, isn't it?
It's an amazing quote. And he said, I'm not going to apologize for it. You have to accept that I have changed. And, you know, if the Oscars don't happen, then que sera, sera. That's paraphrased. And then today he announced, he said, I'd like to apologize to the LGBTQ community, and I will no longer be hosting the Oscars.
He was basically told, wasn't he, to make a public apology by the Academy, was my understanding.
Yeah.
And he told them no, and then backed out of it, and yet kind of did a half-hearted apology anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we're not privy to what's been going on, but I imagine he's had a lot of people inside his ear the last few days going, Kevin, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in his statement, he basically said he didn't want to take the focus and the spotlight away from all the people who are going to be up for Oscars on the night. Many of whom, of course, will be playing LGBTQ characters. Mm.
Do you think it's kind of, it goes back to the James Gunn thing a little bit. It's like, and especially with stand-up comics by their nature tend to say very outrageous shit. Like Sarah Silverman in particular, her routines were extraordinarily close to the bone sort of 10, 15 years ago. And obviously now she's headlining Disney movies and whatnot. And it's just like, I genuinely don't know what the correct path is in this.
Mm.
I would have thought hosting the awards is probably a slightly different thing. But
I think people would have let this go had there been the slightest bit of contrition on his part.
Yeah,
yeah,
maybe so. And also, if he did that stand-up routine now, it would clearly not be acceptable in the slightest. But
I don't think he knows that. I think he's smart enough to know that. But
yeah.
Anyway, so now we have the exciting wait for another Oscar host. No idea who it is. It has become seen as, I think, a bit of a poison chalice in recent years, and I'm not sure who is going to particularly want it, because they want someone who will benefit them. And the only people right now who would host the Oscars are people who are going to benefit from it rather than bring something to it. And I'm not sure who that leaves, really. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. Interestingly, the Golden Globes hosts this week were announced as Sandra Oh and, I was about to say Jake Peralta, that's wrong, Andy Samberg, which I think is a really exciting pairing. I think she's fantastic. He's obviously a very, very funny guy, but also, I think importantly, he's a very funny guy who doesn't mind sharing the spotlight, which I think you need to do as a co-host. So I'm kind of excited to see what they do.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think you need to get someone who's really, obviously someone who's got a really squeaky clean record.
Mm.
Superman might be the best person to do this.
But it's also how Superman needs to be fun to watch as well.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, really good people have hosted the Oscars and not done a great job in the past. So, I mean, I think it's a difficult thing to pull off because the Oscars can be very long-winded and tedious. So, you know, and you really have to balance that, and you've got to bring levity to it, and you've got to maybe make it feel pacey and fun without singing a song about seeing people's boobs, for the love of Christ.
That was a disaster. They should just, every year, they should perform a comedian at the Oscars until the Oscars starts nominating comedians instead, because that was honestly the highlight, I think, of my Oscar viewing over the past 20 years. I think that was amazing.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen that, go look it up. A comedian at the Oscars performed by Will Ferrell and Jack Black and John C. Reilly. And it's,
I don't think I've seen
it's
that.
Glorious. Have you not? Oh, you have. You must have done.
Have I?
It's so good.
Okay. All right.
Anyway.
I'll check it out. But enough talk about the Oscars.
Yes, let's move on.
So the Golden Globe nominations were announced yesterday, and we at the Empire Podcast are obviously going to give them the time that the Golden Globes fully deserves. Anyway, on to Bond news now. It was announced today that by Baz Bamiboy, the great Baz Bamiboy, who knows his Bond onions, his bunions, and he has announced that Léa Seydoux is going to return for Bond 25 as Dr. Madeleine Swan. And this is what I wanted to bring up, and I think, Helen,
yes,
get your soapbox out. It's an older actor and a younger lady, but it's also Bond. This is in your wheelhouse. Well, go.
Yeah, this is actually not the most offensive thing, because at least it's Bond not treating women as being completely disposable and completely changing them up from film to film.
Until she gets fridged in the first 20 minutes.
And well, then it's her swan song.
Oh, that is true. Listen, they may well do that. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you want this to be the news, the casting news, and they don't announce if there's another Bond girl. Because if they announce any other woman right now, we're going to be like, well, they're them. So it was nice playing with you. Thanks very much. Sorry, you're dead now. And also it would be nice because then we wouldn't have to go through all the, you know, tabloid stories about the new Bond girl, which are so tedious to me and a large part of the reason that I don't like this franchise. We're also obviously hearing that Ralph Fiennes is back as M, Ben Whishaw's back obviously as Q, and Naomi Harris is Moneypenny, so that's all good news as well. But
the gang's all here.
The gang is all here. So, you know, let's hope that this is a step in the right direction. I mean, she's half his age, but, you know, at least she's 2 years older than the last Bond girl.
Yeah. So I think this is kind of interesting. I don't know where they're going to go with it. I would hope that the director, Kari Joji Fukunaga, he knows his onions. He's not his Bond onions, his bunions. He's not going to be someone who fridges someone in the first 20 minutes. So her presence in this movie intrigues me. Are they going to try and make a fist of Bond? Stop it, James. Are they going to try to get a fist of Bond actually having a long-term relationship with someone? Or are they now just friends? Is this a Ross Rachel type thing? What's going to happen?
Fuck buddies.
You never know. Or are they, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this, but the casting of her and the return of Fiennes and Whishaw and Harris sets this up very much as a continuation of Skyfall and Spectre.
Yeah. And that's kind of what Fukunaga said. He said, Bond is on a character arc that started with Casino Royale, and I will be carrying that on. So that does suggest some kind of continuity and grand overarching story, which would make sense then for her to be returning.
Strong and stable leadership, if you will.
No, absolutely not.
Does that worry you a little slightly? Because Spectre was not well received.
I still
think the first hour is pretty terrific. It falls off a cliff big time once Christoph Waltz turns up as Blofeld.
Yeah, it does.
Very much so. Maybe you can salvage bits from the wreckage and jettison the rest, maybe.
Christoph Waltz, namely.
Well, pretty much.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're excited.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's been sequel news this week. Aquaman's sequel is in early development, based, I think, chiefly on the good word of mouth so far about Aquaman. I think we're going to be talking about that next week, Chris. Is that correct?
That is correct, Helen, and also in our Aquaman spoiler special podcast with director James Wan spilling the beans on Aquaman. That will be out whatever the next Monday is.
In Spain, is it called Aguaman?
Supongo que sí.
I don't know what you're saying.
I don't know. I've never seen
it. Sí, avol, oui.
Brilliant. Also in sequel news, the Crazy Rich Asian sequels, two of them are to shoot back-to-back, which makes a lot of sense because it's a very big cast to get together. So just do them at once.
I'm all in for that.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, I think. The follow-up books are interesting. They move a little bit away from Rachel and Nick, our original sort of twosome, into the wider circle of their friends and so on. So Gemma Chan's character gets a lot more to do in this one. It's going to be kind of widening out and broadening the story.
I read today the Wikipedia summaries of both those books.
Yeah.
And they go bonkers.
Oh, there's all sorts of, like, you know, international intrigue.
Yeah,
there's a little bit of a murder plot. Yeah, you know.
Jinx. Helen. Helen now can't. Oh, fuck. I said her name. Now she can speak.
So you've messed that up.
I've already ruined the jinx.
Yeah.
And they're going to be, that's exciting. Exciting.
So,
shall we move on to the big trailer news of the week? I mean, the big trailer news of the week is probably going to happen at some point while I'm editing this.
Well, isn't there? People are also saying that there's a Spider-Man trailer that's imminent.
Yes,
and I'm fascinated to see what, if anything, will be in that trailer, because presumably it will just be ash blowing in the wind.
Well,
you
for,
monster
for a minute and a half.
You monster. Well, interestingly, this week Jake Gyllenhaal joined
Instagram
and revealed
yes
that he's a bit shocked he isn't playing Spider-Man, basically, and that he's disturbed to be playing Mysterio. I really recommend looking him up on Instagram because it's actually quite a funny little clip. That's exciting Spider-Man news. So yes, a Spider-Man Homecoming sequel trailer, not to be confused with the other Spider-Man news in the news at the moment about the Spider-Verse, maybe coming this week.
Yes.
Story goes that the Avengers trailer we're all actually like we need like I've had the shakes for 3 days now. We need it.
I've gone the other direction, Helen. I don't want to see it.
You don't want to see it.
I genuinely don't want to see it.
Okay.
I know I'll have to see it, and time permitting, there may be an Avengers trailer breakdown podcast listening, waiting for people by the time you know they hear this almost. But I kind of want to go into this film knowing as little about it as possible. Given that I would be writing about it for Empire, that's going to make it pretty problematic. But
The story goes it was going to come out on Wednesday, and then they basically pushed it because George Bush's funeral got in the way.
Well, there you go. But there was a trailer this week.
Yes.
Okay. So by the time people listen to this, there'll be three trailers maybe. But anyway, let's focus on one we know is definitely out, and that is
Captain Marvel.
Okay.
Now, I enjoyed this trailer because I am looking forward to the film because it is an MCU film and will therefore be brilliant. However, this was perhaps not the best trailer. It set... I don't know. There was something wasn't quite right for me, and I think it was maybe summed up in the last shot where very CGI heavy, very space heavy, and it felt a little DCEU rather than MCU in terms of vibe. And that troubled me slightly.
I disagree.
That is fine.
But I really, really like the space stuff, actually. I just thought that looked really super cool. So I was kind of interested to see that. I'm still not quite clear on the story, and I don't think this made it any clearer, if anything.
I think it's quite dense. It looks like it's going to be a dense one.
Yeah, it does a bit, potentially. But at the same time, I kind of enjoyed everything that's there, and I like her, so I'm kind of...
I mean, she's great.
Well, yeah, she's great.
And she has a variety of rather fun looks in this as well, and I enjoyed her beating up an odd woman on the train as well.
Well, of course you did.
Yeah.
Yes, the trailer came out, and it filled in a little bit more about the story, I think, a little bit. It introduced the word Skrulls for the first time in this trailer. I thought this was going to be the final trailer for Captain Marvel. Clearly, it is not. We heard Ben Mendelsohn as the chief baddie talk for the first time. We heard Jude Law talk for the first time in this movie. We heard him talk before. no big surprise. And we got a little bit more of a hint of the relationship between Carol Danvers, Brie Larson, and Sam Jackson's Nick Fury.
We got a squee over the Kree.
We did.
Yeah, that was fun. Enjoyed a bit of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's very interstellar-y.
Oh.
No, not the film, Helen. I mean, literally.
I liked the trailer. I didn't love the trailer, but I don't think it had quite the impact the first trailer did.
Yeah.
But, you know, listen.
Yeah.
We know that
Nick Fury is a cat person, which, you know, is a bit of a surprise to me, but I suppose it does make sense. Mm. Sly, untrustworthy things. Mm.
I did a poll earlier on this week about how Fury loses his eye, and a lot of people said that the cat was going to scratch it out. That was not an option in the poll. unfortunate dildo mishap was the winner, so there's still time for Marvel to put that in there.
Wow, that would be a change. That would be a real, okay.
Dick
Super
Fury,
good.
If you will.
No.
Shall we end it there and move on to reviews?
I think we probably should, yes.
And now let us talk about, sorry to bother you, James Dyer, but I actually have to ask you to talk about a film. Are you okay? Are you going to be okay doing this bit? Need somebody to hold your hand?
Massive spoiler, I actually watched it. I saw a film for the podcast and everything. Oh, it's extraordinary. Yes, this is,
did you
fact,
trip and fall and accidentally watch it? What happened?
Actually exactly what happened. I tripped and fell and I woke up. I was in a screening and it was on and I was extraordinary, so I stayed.
Well, I'm here now.
Might have been a dream, and given the nature of the film, I can't rule that out. So this is, on the face of it, the story of Cassius Green. No, it's pronounced Cassius Green or Cassius Green. Played by Lakeith Stanfield. And he is a down-on-his-luck unemployed person who gets a job in a call centre, essentially doing telesales. It takes place in a kind of weird, sort of almost dystopian alternate vision of America. And it's, at its very heart, an anarchic, surrealist, somewhat macabre satire of race, consumerist culture and modern America, but essentially through the lens of telesales, as all great satire should be.
Yes. So what he does is he is struggling in his telesales job, and he is advised by a fellow worker, played by Danny Glover, that he would do better if he used a white voice.
Yeah.
So he uses a white voice, which is dubbed entirely by a different actor.
Indeed.
Is it Patton Oswalt or Steve Buscemi?
Patton Oswalt does Amari Hardwick's voiceover.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. He does a white voice and then rises very, very quickly through the corporate ranks and comes to the attention of Armie Hammer's eccentric and possibly sinister billionaire.
They're showing that his advancement is obviously limited by the fact that he's black, and the second that people believe he's white, suddenly the sky's the limit and he becomes ridiculously successful. And the sort of the whole white voice thing is something that's been lampooned by black comedians famously for years.
Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor.
Absolutely, yeah. And it is genuinely very funny, but it takes a very dark turn, and to talk about it in detail would obviously be to ruin it. It is not in any way what it seems, and it certainly doesn't go where you expect it to go. It goes completely batshit. I really liked this. I thought it was very distinctively told. Like, it felt like a Michel Gondry film, actually. In fact, Gondry's kind of punned on at one point in the film. I think he's a really interesting voice, and he told this story very well. My only, perhaps, slight criticism of it is it left me slightly emotionally cold. Like, I felt you didn't really care a great deal for these characters. I didn't think they were hugely... You didn't warm to them that much. They weren't hugely likable. So they told a very effective story, mm-hmm. and they held a very effective mirror up to society, but I didn't root for them. So I think if, for that reason alone, I wasn't as, you know, up on this as perhaps I could have been. But I thought it was very, very good. It's definitely worth seeing because it's incredibly original and a very interesting story. But
yeah,
also...
Yeah.
Nuts.
I think this is a startling debut. I can't wait to see where he goes. I think he's 47 now, Boots Riley, and he's been trying to make movies for a long, long time. And this just feels like a movie made by a man who just thinks this might be my only chance to make a movie. So I'm going to throw everything I possibly can at the wall. And not all of it sticks, but what does is dazzling. Visually and structurally, he tries things here that are just, especially in the budget that he had, kind of amazing. And I applaud that. I always love it when filmmakers... swing for the fences, as they say. Yeah, I really like this. I don't think it'll be to everyone's taste. It certainly goes really weird in the third act with some plot developments that'll leave people cold. But I think the performances are great. The Keith Stanfield is a wonderful proxy for the audience. You know, he has a suitable level of bewilderment all the way through the movie. And I cannot wait to see what Boots Riley did. I think this man's confidence is astonishing. So he had a very public spat with Spike Lee about Black Klansman, and then they met at an award ceremony a few weeks ago, and Boots Riley tweeted something along the lines of that he and Spike had met, and you know they'd complimented each other, and Spike Lee had said, "You're Miles Davis," and Boots Riley went on Twitter, he went, "I'm not Miles Davis, I'm Jimi Hendrix," and I just I don't know the last time I saw a filmmaker come along with that sort of confidence. You know what I mean? It's just to go, it's my first film, but I'm the greatest guitar player of all time. And I kind of love that about it. So there we go. 4 stars then for Sorry to Bother You. And next up we have, this could be, the farewell of Robert Redford from the big screen. Maybe.
Yes.
The Old Man and the Gun.
The Old Man and the Gun. It is, he has said it will be his last film as an actor, at least. Although, I mean, you know, if you came up with something really good, maybe we could get him back. But as it stands, I think it's a wonderful note to go out on. He plays a real-life figure who was an absolutely unrepentant, dyed-in-the-wool bank robber, like, for life. Like, he was first arrested in his pre-teens, and he just didn't stop until he was in his 80s, which is, of course, essentially where we meet him in this story. He occasionally does jobs with two old buddies, played by Danny Glover and Tom Waits.
It's Danny Glover week, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty good if you can get it. And he strikes up a relationship with a widow who lives on her own farm. He's played by Sissy Spacek. But really, it's just about the kind of the joy of doing what you were put on this earth to do, no matter how... I don't know, illegal it might be. and it's kind of a wonderful note for Redford to go out on. Obviously, it plays on, you know, the films that we saw him in, the great films of the past, things like The Sting, things like, obviously, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Mm-hmm. You know, it's playing on lots of...
Lions for Lambs.
Very, very,
very much so.
So much Lions for Lambs in there. I liked Lions for Lambs. I think I was the only one. but it does play on that stuff. It even uses some of his old headshots as mugshots. It's a really charming film, and it just reminds you how charming he is and how daring as well, because it's not, you know, a normal sort of crime film at all. Casey Affleck plays the cop who's trying to stop him. Good luck with that. And and it's just a lovely film. It's I guess a comedy, but not. It's kind of a drama. I don't know how to define it.
Where would you rank it in terms of David Lowery's films?
I'd rank it up towards the top, but then I was not a fan of Ghost Story, for example. Mm-hmm. So didn't love Ain't Them Bodies Saints. I think this is, you know, they obviously worked together before on Pete's Dragon. Yeah. So this is at the more accessible end of his movie making spectrum like that. But at the same time, it doesn't feel quite as conventional, frankly, as that did. I mean, it was a very sweet, good conventional film, but it was a conventional piece of storytelling. And this is a little bit more off to one side. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed this.
Who knows? Maybe David Lowery. Maybe he's found this late stage of his life. Maybe he's found a collaborator that he can work with. And who knows? Lowery might come up with something else and drag him back in. He's doing Gawain and the Green Knight as his next movie. So you never know.
You never know. I mean, look, this is something that I think Redford essentially brought to him. So maybe he'll read another article in a magazine and think, hey, you know, this could work too, David.
Absolutely.
Have a look.
How much is a pint of milk? Look at this. Look at this adapted into a film, David Lowery, he would say. 4 stars down for The Old Man and the Gun. Very exciting. Up next, we have a Matthew McConaughey film directed by Jan Demange, who was, of course, one of the frontrunners for Bond 25. Not anymore, though, but he has directed White Boy Rick, Hell's Bells.
This is the story of the FBI's youngest ever informer, who was basically, as a teenager, essentially pressurized by the police, the local police in Detroit and the FBI, to work for them as an informant on a gang of drug dealers. His sister was mixed up in it. She was a user, and his father was down on his luck. He's played by here by Matthew McConaughey. He just kind of got swept up in it to rather bad outcomes, let's say.
Okay.
This is based on a true story. And it, as such, it doesn't have a neat progression, let's say. It doesn't.
It's not a three-act structure thing.
It's not a traditional three-act structure. And as such, that can be quite frustrating because it kind of feels like it wants to be. And yet it doesn't have that payoff that you maybe want at the end. But you know, good performances. Richie Merritt is the newcomer as Rick himself. He's really pretty good. Matthew McConaughey's great as his slightly eccentric sort of, you know, hustler kind of dad, and you've got Belle Powley, who's always good, as his sister. Great supporting cast as well. This is one of those films that adheres to the current advice that you should have Brian Tyree Henry in everything. So thankfully he's in there as a Detroit cop. You've got Jennifer Jason Leigh as one of the FBI agents as well. So really, really good people. But yeah, just something slightly frustrating about it.
Slightly frustrating about it, but you know, 3 stars.
3 stars. I mean, it's good performances, you know, well shot, beautifully sort of atmospheric, but yeah, just something not quite for me.
And you never guess what we always say in the podcast.
What do we say on the podcast?
We always say 3 stars, you should go and see it.
Oh.
Or something like that. I don't know. It's very hard to remember. 3 stars indeed then for White Boy Rick. Also out this week is Mowgli. You can see it on the big screen at certain cinemas around the country and also on Netflix. We gave it 2 stars. Ollie Richards reviewed this for the magazine. I had more of a good time with it. It is not Jon Favreau's A Jungle Book. It doesn't look the same, as Andy Serkis said in that interview there. They've based the animals very much on the original illustrations. They're not trying to be photoreal animals. It's a darker film than The Jungle Book, any iteration, I think, even the Jason Scott Lee one from a few years ago that you will have seen. So if you are planning to show it maybe to your youngins, I would say be mindful of that.
Yeah.
But we gave it 2 stars. But hey, check it out this weekend and see what you think. And by the way, if you're wondering where our reviews of Aquaman and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse are, we'll review them on next week's show. They're out on Wednesday. Spider-Man previews this weekend. You can go see it. And do go see it because it is fantastic.
Okay.
We gave it 5 stars. It is worth every single one of those. It is unlike any animated film you will have ever seen. That's a promise. And Aquaman is also, I think we can say it now, it's a demented blast. We gave that 3 stars, but we'll review those in depth next week and we'll get into them in greater depth in our spoiler specials as well. They'll be coming your way also. Also next week, in terms of specials, Creed 2 spoiler special is coming your way. Try to get it up this week. Uwer, Finar, Mrs. Couldn't manage it, you know,
Uwer,
certain
Finar,
age,
Mrs.
all that sort of stuff. But I'm going to try and get it up, Uwer, over the weekend, for your pleasure, Finar, and you'll have some...
Wow.
You'll have some fun with that.
I went full Finbar Saunders there.
I did a little bit, didn't I? And there'll be other stuff up next week as well. So there we go. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined for the second time in a month by PJ. Oh, Peter Jackson, Sir Peter Jackson himself, and Philippa Boyens, his long-term co-writer. And they're going to be in to talk about Mortal Engines, Tunbridge Wheels and all. How exciting. Also in that episode may be The League of Gentlemen. All four of them, Rhys Shearsmith, Steve Pemberton, Jeremy Dyson, and Mark Gatiss. But that might also become a special, so keep in peel for that one as well. Until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, because we're going to leave this week's goodbye to Helen O'Hara.
Yeah, I just wanted to dedicate this week's episode to a friend of mine, Ronan Rafferty, who died in the Storm Diana last week in Dublin. He was honestly one of the funniest people I've known in my entire life, and he will be much missed by all of his friends and his family. So just a little shout out to Ronan, bite you, wee man, and thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.